Welcome to the Science Podcast for February 15th, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle on the macroscopic scale, the origins of cosmic rays, and insight into light-sensing proteins.
So they had discovered opsins in the light-producing organ in these comb jellies, and I was just fascinated by the idea that there would be opsins outside the eye.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site. And starting today, we'll be podcasting from the AAAS annual meeting in Boston. You can follow our coverage via iTunes or find all of Science's news and multimedia from the meeting at news.sciencemag.org/sciencenow/AAAS_2013.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society. At www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
Consider microscopic changes in macroscopic systems. LIGO, or the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, is a giant sensor built to detect gravitational waves. It comprises two detectors, thousands of miles apart, each equipped with orthogonal arms that react differently to passing gravitational waves. The changes in the length of these arms, each about 4 kilometers long, are expected to be smaller than the charge radius of a proton. When you're looking at such tiny changes in position, you might have to take into account effects usually only considered at the quantum level, such as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Cindy Regal spoke with me about her team's experiments looking at what happens when you start to see the Heisenberg uncertainty principle at the macro scale.
So let's say I'm watching the trajectory of an object, say a baseball flying across a stadium. It's clear that we don't generally worry about the effect of quantum mechanics on our ability to track that baseball. On the other hand, there's a very famous thought experiment in physics, first considered by Werner Heisenberg. It goes, say I'm trying to watch an electron move around. I get a really good microscope, and I try to pin down the position of that electron. This very act of measuring the electron with light gives the electron a kick in such a way that its position later is uncertain. In our experiment, what we do is something very akin to this original thought experiment, but it's with an object that's much closer to our everyday experience. So it's not a baseball, but we use a little drum that you can carry around with you. It's visible to the naked eye. It's about the size of a really small ant. And we run into the limit where quantum mechanics dictates the motion of that drum must be obscured by the process of measuring it.
Okay, so let's talk about a few of the terms that come up in your paper. What is radiation pressure shot noise in this context?
That's an excellent suggestion. The term radiation pressure shot noise definitely appears as a strange juxtaposition of different words. So let's start with shot noise. Shot noise is a statistical phenomenon that you experience when you listen to, say, the sound of rain coming down on a metal roof. You're hearing the pitter-patter of white noise. That is noise that has a range of different frequency components. The next word that I'll talk about is, how about radiation? That refers to the fact that our measurements are made with light, okay? And then pressure indicates that there are mechanical effects of the light that are at work on our little drum. We can sort of try to put this all together and put it in the context of what I was just talking about. So light actually has a fluctuating intensity that's due to shot noise. So one way you can that can be understood is by thinking about the light as photons, which act like particles and arrive at random, uncorrelated times. In any case, the fluctuating light intensity due to the shot noise causes a fluctuating force on the drum, which makes it vibrate more, which obscures its motion. And that's the basic process going on in our experiment.
Okay, so can you describe a little bit more about what your methodology was? Where was this drum? What did you hit it with?
So in our experiment, what we basically do is we have this little drum, and we embed it in something that we call an optical cavity. And that optical cavity, what we use it for is to measure the position of the little drum. And we have a very specialized way that we put this whole unit together. For our purposes, you can think of the optical cavity as a bottle for light, and it allows us to reflect the light back and forth through the drum many thousands of times. And this gives us a much better ability to measure the position of the drum than if we were just to shine our light off of the drum. In addition to the cavity, we've specifically engineered a number of different aspects of our system to see radiation pressure shot noise. The basic challenge is that you must arrange to see a very small amount of motion. And you have to be sure that that very small amount of motion of the drum is not due to one of many other possible sources mm-hmm. of vibration of the object. So imagine you have a mass and it's hanging at the end of a spring. If you pull the mass, it'll move up and down periodically. And you can try to stop this motion. So you can grab hold of the mass and make it try to stand still. Then imagine letting go of it again. Mm-hmm. However, that mass will probably still be vibrating some due to, say, just the floor wiggling around. And then even if you could isolate the spring from this effect, you would have another effect. That effect is that you'll actually get some motion that's actually just proportional to the temperature of the room that the spring is in physical contact with. Okay, so there's a lot of things to get around. One strategy that we use in our experiment is to just make the whole system quite cold and also put the whole system in a vacuum canister.
So you're eliminating a lot of possible interference there.
That's correct, yes. Lots of random sources of motion. The other things that we do, we also use a very special mechanical element whose vibrational energy decays only after a very large number of oscillations, something like 10 million oscillations.
So in these experiments, you're showing that detection can cause uncertainty. Basically, this is a mechanism for enforcing the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And this is especially an issue for plans to measure gravitational waves. Why might this uncertainty at the macro scale cause a problem in these measurements?
The very basic reason why gravitational wave detectors are expected to run into quantum limits is because they're trying to detect a really small effects.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, our experiment is different in quite a number of different ways compared to a useful detector of anything at this point, let alone gravitational waves. But maybe what I can do is explain the basic conundrum that quantum mechanics enforces when you're trying to continuously measure the position of an object, maybe in the context of something like our experiment. So a basic ubiquitous limit to measurement is shot noise itself. Okay, so generally a strategy is when you're measuring something with light, the more light you use in the measurement, the more you can beat down the shot noise.
Mm-hmm.
And this strategy works as long as nothing gets worse as you increase the amount of light that you're using. But that's exactly what radiation pressure shot noise is. It's a fundamental limitation that increases as you turn up the light. Hence, you have to use an amount of light that balances these two effects, shot noise and radiation pressure shot noise. And in the simplest picture, you can't measure any better than what's allowed at that special point.
So going back to your metaphor, it's like a downpour of rain. You can no longer distinguish individual beats. You're not getting a pulsing effect. But now you have a downpour, and it's causing other problems with measurement.
The downpour is sort of like the light. Mm-hmm. And that has an effect on your ability to detect the shot noise. But it's the fact that the downpour is now actually physically driving up your mechanical object.
Mm-hmm.
So the force of the downpour is also causing another limitation to measurement.
Right. Uncertainty is not going to go away. But are there some ways to get around this problem in the context of detecting gravitational waves?
Basically, yes, absolutely. What I described just now was the simplest method to monitor an object. And one aspect of radiation pressure shot noise is that it has a rich history. And while studying it with solid objects is just starting, mm-hmm. there's been a lot of thought over the years about getting around what we call the standard quantum limit, which is what I just described earlier. Mm-hmm. And I can give you the basic story in a slightly more specific language than we've been using. So again, just sort of allow me to state a basic thought experiment here. So say I'm trying to measure the position of an object, and I measure it to an amount I'll call the variable delta x. Then the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which I was talking about at the very beginning, says then the momentum is uncertain to a constant called h bar over delta x. And this wouldn't be an issue for measuring delta x later, except for the fact that position and momentum are linked together.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, momentum is proportional to the speed of the object, and the speed, of course, determines the position at a later time.
Mm-hmm.
So to make a long story short, if you measure other variables other than strictly position that aren't linked in this specific way, it's one way to work around the problem.
I see.
And there's actually a very beautiful article in Science from I guess it's over 30 years ago now, 1980, I think, by Vladimir Berginsky and co-authors. And they laid out exactly how you can keep quantum mechanics from getting in the way when making precision measurements. And a general goal in our community now is to start working with some of those ideas experimentally.
All right. Well, Cindy Regal, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Cindy Regal and colleagues write about uncertainty at the macro scale. You can read the report and a related perspective in this week's Science.
Hey everyone, this week's show is sponsored by Audible.com, and they're offering a special deal to Science Podcast listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And in case you're having difficulty deciding, we thought we'd give you a few recommendations. I found several books by one of my favorite nonfiction authors, Oliver Sacks. To start off with him, I would pick The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat or An Anthropologist on Mars. Both of which are collections that cover a lot of interesting ground in the world of clinical psychology. Okay, Carrie, what did you pick?
Well, I went with Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries by Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's a real lighthearted look at astrophysics and the evolution of stars.
That does sound like fun. So, podcast listeners, check out these books and more from Audible, and don't forget to get your free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
We may not be able to feel them, but we are constantly being bombarded by high-energy particles from outer space, so-called cosmic rays. Cosmic rays consist primarily of protons traveling at relativistic speeds. But how do these protons come to travel so fast? Stefan Funk and colleagues sought out the answer to this question in the gamma ray emissions of two nearby supernovae. He spoke with me about what they found and why determining the origins of these protons was so challenging in the first place.
The reason why this is difficult to find the sources of cosmic rays is cosmic rays mostly consist of protons. They arrive here on Earth from outer space with enormous energies, but because they are mostly protons, they are deflected by magnetic fields on their way from the source, wherever they are accelerated, to Earth. And therefore, we can't use them to pinpoint where they come from. And therefore, in our study, we used the gamma rays. Gamma rays are basically like visible light, just a factor of about a billion times more energetic. And these gamma rays can be produced by the energetic protons and then can travel in straight lines to us, so we can use the gamma rays to pinpoint where the cosmic rays are accelerated. For this study, we have used NASA's Fermi Large Area Telescope, which is a telescope on an orbiting satellite. And we used this instrument to detect gamma rays that we could unambiguously connect to the accelerated protons from two remnants of supernova explosions in our galaxy. These are called IC443 and W44. And with this measurement, we now demonstrated that these supernova remnants can accelerate protons and are therefore sources of cosmic rays.
So tell me, what are cosmic rays used for here on Earth, and why is it important to understand where they come from?
First of all, they're very important energetically in our galaxy. They provide a substantial fraction of the total energy budget of our galaxy. We've known now for 100 years that our Earth's atmosphere is constantly being bombarded by these high-energy particles. And even though we discovered them 100 years ago, we haven't figured out where they come from. And the reason for that is mainly that because these protons are deflected in the magnetic fields, they arrive with the same intensity from all directions, and we can't do astrophysics with them. Now, even though they are individually at times very energetic, often more energetic than what we can produce at terrestrial accelerators, we can't, unfortunately, harvest this energy to solve our energy problem or something like that. So we can't really use them for anything that we would like to use them, but they are just an interesting phenomena because they point to very energetic processes in our galaxy and in our universe.
Okay, so as you said, you turned to gamma rays, basically, to understand the sources of these protons within cosmic rays. So tell me, what exactly were you analyzing and what specific signatures were you searching for?
So, as I previously said, we can't use the protons to do astrophysics, but what the protons do, the accelerated protons, they can run into protons that are just surrounding the supernova explosion in the interstellar medium. And if they do that, they interact with these low-energy protons and create pions. Mm. This is a process that is well known from particle physics. People have discovered that in the 1950s. And these pions are basically like protons. They consist of quarks, but they are very different in the sense that they are very, very short-lived, just a tiny fraction of a second, and after that they decay into gamma rays. So this process, the process of accelerated protons running into low-energy protons, creating pions, and then decaying into gamma rays, is how we can see the accelerated protons.
Hence the search for gamma rays.
Hence the search for gamma rays, exactly.
And how do you differentiate gamma rays emitted by this pion decay versus gamma rays emitted by other processes?
Yes, this is very important. So the beauty of this decay of the pions into gamma rays is that it has a very, very characteristic signature. And this characteristic signature shows up in the energy distribution of the gamma rays. There's a clear deficit of gamma rays below a certain energy, and this energy below which there's a deficit, we can actually predict with our physical theories that describe this decay. And so we turned our attention of the telescope towards these two supernova remnants, and what we found is that they are very bright in gamma rays, but they have this deficit below a certain energy, which clearly tells us that what we are seeing are gamma rays that are produced by the decay of neutral pions, hence gamma rays that are related to the acceleration of cosmic rays, and not gamma rays that are produced by other processes, because we know that there are other processes that can create gamma rays. Most importantly, accelerated electrons can also create gamma rays through various processes. Mm-hmm. And we were looking for the sources of the accelerated protons because they are the dominant part of the cosmic rays. And we wanted to distinguish that from the production of gamma rays through the accelerated electrons.
And so by looking at these two particular supernovas, you were able to see this gamma ray signature that you were looking for.
Yes, absolutely. This clear deficit at low energies is something we were looking for. And by studying these two supernova remnants, we actually found this clear signature.
And how do these protons become accelerated in the first place?
So it's very important that the particles are not accelerated in the explosion itself, but there's a process going on that this shock wave, which basically contains some of the kinetic energy of the explosion, this shock wave picks up particle as it moves along and accelerates these particles to enormous energy. The idea is that as this shock wave moves through the interstellar space, there are magnetic fields that are connected to this shock wave, and these magnetic fields bounce particles off them. And what happens is that the protons bounce off these magnetic fields that move with the shock wave, and therefore the protons traverse this shock many times. And every time they travel through this shock itself, they gain some energy. And eventually, they leave the shock region when they have too high energy, so they can no more be bounced off the magnetic field. And then they travel as cosmic rays until eventually they hit Earth or something else. An analogy that is sometimes used is that of two tennis players. So the tennis players would be the magnetic fields that are connected to the shock wave. And then one would be rushing towards the net and the other would be moving away from the net a little bit more slowly. And they volley the tennis ball back and forth, and it gets faster and faster until one of the player hits it out, and then at that time the tennis ball, the cosmic ray, would leave. The process of accelerating particles in shockwave was first theorized by the Italian-American physicist Enrico Fermi. Hence, it's quite nice that the Fermi Large Area Telescope now finds this confirmation of the Fermi acceleration of protons in supernova remnants.
Okay, so let's sum up. So during the explosion of a dying star into a supernova, a shockwave is released. This shockwave accelerates protons, and when those protons interact with interstellar dust and gas clouds, they produce pions. And then the pions themselves decay into gamma rays, which is what you're measuring.
That's correct.
So now that you've confirmed this whole shockwave pion decay process, what's next?
Okay, so this is a big step because for the first time, it unambiguously tells us that the shockwave of supernova explosion can produce cosmic rays. Now, admittedly, this does not tell us that supernova remnants produce all of the cosmic rays we find here. There are a lot of reasons to believe that supernova remnants are responsible for the majority of cosmic rays. First of all, if you look at possible sources of cosmic rays, there are actually not many objects in our galaxy that have enough energy to sustain the flux of cosmic rays over long periods of time. And we know that the flux of cosmic rays is stable over long periods of time from, for example, C14 measurements in ice. So the next step is really to ask the question, do supernova remnants really accelerate the majority of the cosmic rays?
Mm-hmm.
And we have detected quite a number of additional supernova remnants with the Fermi Large Area Telescope, and we're going to try this study to look for this deficit at low energies for more of these remnants. But this is something that we want to do in the future. And then the other area that we really want to study in the future is exactly how does the acceleration process work, up to what energy do supernova remnants accelerate particles, questions like that.
Great. Well, Stefan Funk, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Stefan Funk and colleagues write about pion decay and the origins of cosmic rays in a report in this week's issue.
Sight relies on light-sensitive proteins that undergo a change after interacting with light. The change in the light-sensing proteins found in the retina of the eye is transformed into a signal that can be read by the brain, and eventually, the signal becomes part of the visual field, what we see. I spoke with Science News writer Elizabeth Panisi about tracing the origins of these sensing molecules by looking for them in eyeless animals and other unexpected places.
Opsins are light-sensitive proteins, mostly found in the eye, and when light hits them, they change their shape a little bit and set off a signaling cascade that eventually relays the message that there's light to the brain.
So what made you decide to write a story on these proteins?
Well, I had written a story a couple of months ago about opsins in comb jellies. So they had discovered opsins in the light-producing organ in these comb jellies, and I was just fascinated by the idea that there would be opsins outside the eye. And then I went to a meeting, and lo and behold, there were several talks about different organisms and all of them having to do with opsins being found in different places.
So eyeless creatures, like the comb jelly, have genes for these light-sensitive proteins. Can you give some examples of how they might be used non-visually?
So, for example, in the comb jellies, the opsins are sensitive to the same wavelength as the light produced, the bioluminescence produced by the comb jelly,
mm-hmm.
and they're located in the bioluminescent organ.
Mm-hmm.
So researchers think that the opsins are used to sort of monitor how much light is being produced by the comb jelly. So that's one example, sort of a non-visual role. In the hydra, they find these opsins in cells located near the stinging cells. Hydra are cnidaria. Cnidaria are a group of organisms characterized by having these cells being full of these barbs that they shoot off in defense or to get food. And it turns out that these stinging cells are influenced by light. And the thinking is that the opsins sense the light and then cause the stinging cells to either fire more or fire less.
So they may be doing less shooting of their barbs in the dark? Is that kind of the thinking?
Well, actually, I think it's less shooting of their barbs in the bright light.
Oh, really interesting. So those are a couple examples of how these are used in invertebrates. Are any of these opsins found in vertebrates, not in the eyes?
Well, it turns out that one of the first examples of opsins not in the eyes comes from the discovery of opsins in frog skin. And this was in 1998, and the researchers knew that the skin of amphibians was light sensitive, and so they tracked down the opsins, and it turned out to be an unusual looking opsin that then they since found in nerve cells and brains of other vertebrates. So it's used for helping to set circadian rhythm.
So it detects light, but it doesn't contribute to vision.
Right.
So there are also examples of opsins reacting to other cues from the environment besides light. What are they doing inside the ears of things like fruit flies?
Ah, so it turns out that fruit flies have in their antennal ears, they have four opsins, and they're located in the mechanosensory hairs of the antenna. So just like we have little hairs inside our ears that respond to vibrating, these hairs in the fruit fly respond to vibrating. And so the opsins are thought to be used in that regard. So they're not light sensitive at all.
And so can we talk a little bit about how this protein is used so broadly from invertebrates all the way up to fruit flies and frogs? What does it say about the evolution of sensation or detecting the environment and the history of these proteins?
Well, the picture that is emerging is that opsins are very ancient. Mm-hmm. Researchers used to think that there was one kind of opsin in vertebrates and another kind of opsin in invertebrates. Now they realize that both kinds of opsins are found in both kinds of organisms for different uses and different varieties. The fact that they find opsins in cells that are used for sensing other kinds of stimuli, such as the hydra, and also in the octopus. So in the hydra, the opsins are located in the cells that are used for taste perception. And in the octopus, they have opsins in their eyes, of course, but they also have opsins in the cilia on their skin, and those cilia are sensitive to touch. And so the thinking is that perhaps the ancestral photoreceptor cell that houses opsins was really a cell that was sensitive to multiple stimuli, and that its photoreceptor cell was specialized from there.
So it was a Swiss Army knife detector, and now we have many, many different kinds of detectors.
Something like that, yes.
All right. So octopus change color, right?
Right.
So could that also be related to this?
Yes, it could be. It's in a squid. What they find is the opsins are in the associated with the chromophores, which are the pigment cells that let the pigment expand and contract depending on what color they are. So, oh, yeah.
Really neat. Really neat. Well, Elizabeth Panisi, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Elizabeth Panisi is a staff writer for Science. She writes about opsins in a News Focus this week.
Carrie Klein here, and I've got online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, Dave, in our first story, we've got some new clues about the origin of life.
Right, Carrie. Well, this story is about where did we all come from? How did life start? You know, there was some thinking a while ago that maybe there was these molecules that assembled into DNA in early seas, and then this DNA somehow became encapsulated in cells and sort of things took off from there. But recently, scientists have thought that maybe it was RNA instead of DNA, and RNA is sort of the cousin of DNA, and actually there are some organisms that actually have a genome just based on RNA. The thing with RNA, that the advantages it has is that it's more chemically reactive than DNA, which means that if you've got a bunch of RNA or RNA precursors in the water, they're more likely to start bonding to each other than you would have with something similar to DNA. But the problem is that even in water, scientists have shown that the nucleotides, these sort of letters, the A, G, C, T for DNA, U for RNA, they found that these building blocks of RNA don't spontaneously assemble. So it seemed to be a detraction for that hypothesis that these molecules are floating around just sort of automatically formed RNA.
So what insight does this new study bring to that RNA theory?
Well, researchers think they have found a way that RNA could have assembled in early seas. They toyed with this idea of what they're calling proto-RNA. And this is sort of a much simpler version of RNA. It involves just two chemicals. One is called cyanuric acid, or CA, and the other is triaminopyrimidine, if I'm saying that right, and I probably am not. We'll call it TAP for short. And TAP comes from a family of compounds that are known as pyrimidines, as do the RNA bases C and U. So it's a real relative of what we see in RNA today. today. Previous research has shown that when CA and TAP were put in an organic solvent, groups of three CAs and three TAPs would spontaneously form these ring-like structures called rosettes, and these rosettes would then stack on each other, forming long chains. And you can begin to see that when you have all these molecules starting to stack on each other, you start to get much more complex molecules, something maybe resembling RNA. But when researchers put CA and TAP together in water, they tend to clump into large ribbons and they quickly fall out of solutions, meaning that they don't seem like good candidates for what the researchers were sort of considering proto-RNAs.
Right.
So what the researchers did in the new study was they think they've solved this problem. They gave TAP a short chemical tail, which transformed it into a chemical they call TAPAS, T-A-P-A-S. It makes me hungry just thinking about it. And they found that one change, the simple change, encourages it to assemble with CA and form rosettes in water. So it didn't have the problems that researchers had seen before. And what's more, these rosettes actually stacked on top of one another, as you would sort of hope for these simple molecules forming much more complex molecules. And they form these long chains that actually sort of resemble genes in a way, made up of as many as 18,000 TAPAS and CA components. So you're really starting to see this assembly of things that begin to look like very early versions of genes just with these two fairly simple molecules.
So do we know if these molecules were even around billions of years ago?
We don't know that. And the other thing we don't know is even if these types of proto-RNAs could actually encode information. And that's really the important thing, because DNA and RNA, that's the blueprint for our cells. So it's not just having the structure itself. It's having this structure that's able actually to encode instructions that would enable these very, very early cells to actually carry out activities. And until that's solved, we're really not going to know whether these CAs, these TAPAS, these sort of proto-RNA-like molecules may have actually resembled some of the earliest forms of genetic information on the planet.
Right. And so now let's fast forward a couple billion years to when humans began to split into hunter-gatherers and farmers.
Well, Carrie, one of the most important things that happened in human history happened about 11,000 years ago. And this was the beginning of the Neolithic period. This is the period where a lot of human populations began settling down. They were transitioning from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to really settling down as farmers. And this Neolithic revolution, as it's called, is when we started growing crops, domesticating plants and animals, really forming the first permanent villages, which eventually became cities. So an incredibly important time in human history.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about this time is not all populations around the globe were doing this. There were still a lot of groups of humans that were still engaged in what was called a Mesolithic culture. They continued to hunt, fish, and gather, so they didn't really settle down. And the big question has been, well, if we have these two different sort of lifestyles going on the planet, what happened when these people met? What happened when the farmers met the hunter-gatherers?
Right. So how can we begin to even understand how that would have happened?
Well, researchers looked at the Balkans, and the Balkans offer a really rare glimpse of this tumultuous time when farmers began to arrive, but that there were still hunter-gatherers on the scene. And they analyzed a lot of skeletons that were buried in a particular region there. The skeletons were dated from about 13,000 to about 7,500 years ago. And this spans a period from just before the Mesolithic to the early Neolithic. And the researchers focused specifically on isotopes of strontium-87 and strontium-86. And these isotopes really vary depending on the soils and the rocks and the environment. They get into the food. And what they give scientists is this lifelong signature of where a person grew up. So researchers can actually tell where people came from just based on looking at these ratios of isotopes.
And this is in their teeth.
In their teeth, exactly. What the researchers found was they found a really significant change in the strontium profile right around the time that the first signs of the Neolithic culture show up in this area. And by sort of digging a little bit deeper, what they found was that there appeared to be a lot of non-local individuals appearing to come from far away, and the number of these immigrants really jumps over time. Before 8,200 years ago, for example, almost all the burials at this specific site that they looked at were locals, But just a couple hundred years later, five of the 19 people they'd found buried in this area were non-locals. They'd come from far away.
So what does, you know, immigration of these early humans tell us about their interactions?
Well, the researchers suspect that these non-locals represent Neolithic migrants, so farmers that were coming from far away, and that they were mixing with local hunter-gatherers. And that suggests that the two groups lived side by side, especially since you're having these common burials of people that are coming from these different regions. So, you know, some people suspected that this may have been a very violent encounter, you know, the hunter-gatherers meeting the farmers, very different lifestyles, maybe very different cultures, maybe they didn't get along very well. But this suggests that they actually may have had a very peaceful coexistence.
But of course, this is only one small sample set from one river in Europe.
Exactly. This was happening all over Europe and elsewhere in the world. And so we can't extrapolate just from this one study to say that it was peaceful everywhere it happened. But at least it looks like everybody was getting along in this particular area of Europe.
All right. And in our third story, we learned something new about ants.
Right, Carrie. Well, scientists found out a few years ago that adult ants of some genuses are actually able to make noise. They have this specialized spike on their abdomen, and they can actually stroke it with their hind legs. It's kind of like dragging the teeth of a comb along the edge of a table. The question in this new study is, do these noises actually serve a purpose? Are they a form of communication? And the reason that's unusual is because scientists have always thought of ants as communicating primarily using pheromones,
right,
which are these sort of chemicals that they can pick up on. And pheromones have been thought to communicate a lot of stuff in ant societies, social status, maybe even where food is. So the question is, well, maybe they make noise, but why do they need to make noise if they're already communicating via pheromones?
So why do they?
Well, one of the interesting things that they found was it wasn't just the adult ants in one of these groups of ants that they looked at. This is a group from Northern Europe. And what they found was that even the mature pupae, which are sort of the stage right before adulthood, were able to make noise. And their noise sounded a little bit different from the adult noise. So you can see it's simpler, and what the researchers think is it is a way of sort of communicating, and they believe that when the adults use this noise, it's kind of an emergency signal. Maybe it's saying like, help, hey, I'm over here, help me, this is your friend. You know, maybe it's, there's a lot of complicated stuff happening in that noise, but with a mature pupae, you're basically maybe just getting something like help. You know, it's a much more simple communication.
So how did scientists determine that this is really what these noises mean?
Well, the first thing they did is they actually played back some of these sounds that the mature pupae made to adult ants. And the adult ants responded by walking over to the speaker that was playing this noise and rubbing their antennae against it and starting to guard it, which suggests that they were interpreting this as maybe an SOS type signal.
Mm-hmm.
And the researchers actually even went a bit further. They removed this abdominal spike from the mature pupae, and they put them in a nest, and they disturbed the nest so that the other ants around would think there was an emergency. And normally what happens is adult ants rescue their nest mates. But when the mature pupae were unable to make sound because their spikes were removed, the adult ants completely ignored them. It was kind of like the mature pupae didn't even exist.
Wow. So why would they communicate with sounds rather than pheromones in this really important scenario?
Well, the researchers think it's because the mature pupae don't yet have the full array of adult pheromones. So they're not actually able to communicate as well as adult ants. You can sort of almost think of it as a baby just learning to speak. And maybe these ants can only say a few words in pheromones. So if an emergency arises, they need another way to signal that they're in trouble. And that's where these noises would come in.
Wow. How cool. All right. Well, so what else has been on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about building earthquake shields for buildings. Another story about how mice can shed light on human evolution. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got an analysis of President Obama's State of the Union speech, what it means for science. Also, the future of science in the European Union, what's going to be happening over there in the coming years. And as you know, Carrie, we're here in Boston. We're covering breaking news from the annual meeting of the AAAS. We're going to be having several stories on our website every day, along with podcasts and a new feature this year. We're going to be doing live video chat with some of the top scientists from the meeting. You can find all this on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and Science Policy from Science Insider. And while you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the February 15th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.